All right, moving on to item three, public comment. This is the opportunity on our agenda for members of the public to provide comment to the board on matters within the purview of the board and purview of the agency, I should say, and the jurisdiction of the agency. Are there any members of the public this morning who wish to make public comment? Seeing none, let's move on to item four, which is always fun. This is an opportunity for us to recognize Karen Reynolds for 5 years of employment with Sisera. I was thinking about this morning, and I'm sure Karen can definitely relate. So you come to work for a new employer and agency in 2019, and you go through months of training and indoctrination, getting used to the system, and within a few months, you're working from home for a couple of years, all right? So real challenging 5 years, and just kind of reflecting on it earlier, I was thinking that's, you know, it's certainly not ideal, but thank you for sticking with it, and we're delighted that you're here. And so from all of us, we want to thank you for 5 years, and we look forward to five more. Thank you. We do have a certificate here for you, signed by the chair and the vice chair. So we'll present that. All right. There's no gold watch today. That's later. Hopefully we won't have another pandemic between now and then. All right. With that, let's move on to item five, consent calendar. We have in the packet and on the agenda for item 5A, the elements of the consent agenda. Are there any comments or changes or questions or things anybody want to pull off consent? All right, we have a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda. Any final questions, discussion? Hearing none. Let's go move on to call the roll. Oh, I think I got it right here. Okay. On the motion, Anderson?
Aye.
Gordon?
Aye.
Holcomb?
Aye.
Kroll?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
Zhu?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Wong?
Aye.
And Finley?
Aye.
All right. That motion carries 9-0. And with that, the board is currently scheduled to go into closed session. Under item six, we will come back into open session following that. Don't stray too far. I don't think this closed session will be lengthy, so hopefully we'll be back soon, and we will reconvene in open session. Thank you. All right. Well, we're assembling. We will reconvene in open session. I'm going to report out from the closed session. The board met in closed session under item six to consider and take possible action regarding the disability retirement application of Brenda Ross. The board determined to follow the recommendation presented and dismiss the application of Brenda Ross. The vote was 9-0. On that vote, the ayes were Anderson, Chabadarev, Gordon, Holcomb, Kroll, McDonald, Zhu, Phillips, and Wong. No nays, 9-0. The application was dismissed. No further action taken in closed session. That would conclude my report out, unless, Karen, you think I need to provide any other information, or is that sufficient?
No, that's sufficient.
All right, thank you. All right, returning to open session then. Item seven. Henry, good morning. Presentation of the 2023 CICERA budget versus actual expenses report. The floor is yours.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Another exciting update on the budget versus actual update. I'm glad you're all ready for it. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the board. This is a very brief routine presentation of the budget versus actual cost for the last fiscal year, January, December of 2023. The format you've seen before on a semi-annual basis when we do the annual update, semi-annual update. Coming up in the next couple of months, we're going to do the budget for next year, and we'll bear down more deeper in the line items. But the way the budget is constructed is we take a look at all the core cost center departments, exec, compliance, retirement services, member services, accounting, IT. We gather those costs, and that's what's considered the admin cost per the SURL rules. We're allowed to measure up a limit against those particular costs. We go through line items, salaries, benefits, professional services, and then office type cost, office overhead. And then we do depreciation too, because that's considered part of cost, being able to amortize certain assets. Those are the admin cost, but for the budget, we also combine the non-admin cost, which are considered the costs we spend for our investment team, our staff, professional services, and also our legal, outside legal, in-house legal staff costs, and some of IT disaster recovery. Those are considered non-administrative, but we include them in our budget and in our presentation because we like to say this is what it takes to run the place. You know, these are the costs besides investment manager fees, things of that nature. So we like to do an update. So very quickly here, the way the presentation here, let's go to page one. Let me see, get our clicker. Go back a little bit. Non-admin. Let me go, here we go. Can we go up on that document to the top a little bit? If not, we can just kind of continue. It's in your packet agenda. So this is page one. This is the page where it summarizes all the administrative and non-administrative costs. The important highlight here is down at the bottom, the little green bubble, is basically from the budget. About three quarters of the entire cost is the administrative cost. And the remaining 28%, a little over a quarter, is non-administrative cost. That gives you an idea of the entire budget, how we're placing these two. The administrative cost is the one that shows up in the actuary report as a component of contribution rates, as spoken about as an admin rate. The non-admin is buried in the ACFR cost as part of cost of investments or part of cost of running the organization. But when we place it together here in our discussion, we talk about these are the budget costs and these are the actual against it. So very quickly here, I'll guide you down to right above the bubble. We have total CICERA expenses. The highlight item here is that our entire budget was 19.7. Against that, we have 17.9 in cost, in actual cost. And it left a difference, what I call a favorable difference, of about 1.7 under budget, about 9%. We could say, wow, look how well we're doing against the budget. But really, when we construct the budget, it's a plan of action of how we're going to spend our money, what are we going to devote it to, what kind of activities. And some might be foreseen and some of it might be unforeseen. The biggest reason why we have the savings is if you look up at the top over in personnel services, the majority of that was from lack of spending on personnel services. And that had to do with a combination of reasons. We're trying to fill some vacancies during that year. We estimate when we expect to fill certain position, and there were some retirement counselor positions that we were looking to fill during that period. We were looking to fill some investment positions, and we have an estimate of when we're going to hire, and then they end up recruiting and starting a few months later after that, and so that causes some kind of savings. Then we have some unforeseens. For the majority of the year, we had a retirement services manager who decided to depart, and so we had a vacancy because we wanted to fill that spot. And we did so this towards later in the year, but it left a gap of about 10 to 11 months during the year, and it caused some of that savings right there. Christina, during her time as deputy, she was wearing multiple hats. Amongst one of them was covering that spot there until we find the right candidate. So there were some other positions that we were deciding about filling as CORS and the new pension system comes closer. We're going to see how some of these functions land, where our need's going to be, and so we might be holding off on filling those positions, and that's what some of that savings is. The rest of it, there's some pluses and minuses, routine ups and downs. I'd be gladly go through any of the items, but I promised that this was going to be a brief update. And so, the headline is that our budget is trending about 9% under. That's been a figure that we've managed to keep for a number of years since I've been here. The diagram tells us roughly what our admin and our non-admin makeup is. The CERL limit is 21 basis points of the actuarial accrued liability. And the last one published was our December 2022 actuarial report. And that number tells us that the actuarial liability is about 11.9 billion of liability, which results in a statutory limit of about 25 million. That's the limit. And our admin expenses came in at 12.8, so that's about half. So that's a well-respected, well-trended position. It means that we're running at a very lean budget and we're matching up to our expected plan. So along that note, the rest of the information, there's another item here at the very tail end, page 4, that I want to draw your attention. This is what's called our capital budget update. There's two things on here, basically where we sit from a financial basis. Oh, okay. Absolutely, yeah. Let me move that. Thank you. That's this page, page 4. Two items on here, the top one being where we stand from a financial basis on the pension system as of December 31st, 2023. We're committed to the project emotionally, physically, we're there, but from a financial basis, this is where we're at. And it tells us, the first column tells us where our contract values are, what we spent against it, what the remaining contract is, and then the percentage. So about two-thirds of the contract has been spent so far as of December. That number is probably notched up a bit from where we're at. Next board meeting, we're going to get another pension update, more nuts and bolts about how the system is coming along. But that's what's considered an asset in progress. As soon as we go live, as soon as this starts running, depreciation is going to amortize on it. And we're entitled to amortize it over 10 years. So that $15 million or so will be divided up over 10 years, and it'll be part of the budget going forward. So right now it's just sitting in place until it launches. So that depreciation cost is going to move down to the bottom part of the schedule there, where you have assets. And these are what's left of all the assets that it took to move up here, which was 5 years ago. Scott was alluding to that. 5 years ago, September 2019, is when we incurred the majority of these. And so some of them are being written down through depreciation. And some of them were entitled to last 10 years, the leasehold improvements. Those go 10 years. So along those lines, that's where we sit. Any exciting questions on any of the data?
One question I have, it's not on the data, it's just in general. Beyond the tracking of the expenditures, which are depicted on the capital budget update, how often do you forecast? Do you do that like monthly or quarterly? Do you look out at any point and try to forecast?
The cost for the pension system?
Overall, right?
Overall?
Yes.
We look at it on a quarterly basis, and we bear down semi-annually. This was as of 6 months ago. We're going to look at 6 months into this year, coming up on the budget, when we start preparing that in October, November. But on a quarter basis, we take a look and we do what's called a soft close. We analyze. During the year, we might have some budget adjustments where we decide, oh, we need to bump up one of the line items. I think we did that a couple months ago. We needed more money for our Siegel project consultant.
Right.
So that's called a budget amendment. So that changes our little forecast in the middle of the year. And so on a quarterly basis, we take a look at actual expenses to see how they're running.
Yeah, so you forecasted probably end of March, and then this is a mid-year true-up, and then you'll do it again.
Correct.
September
Correct.
30, and then you'll true up at the end.
Correct. Okay. And it's an interactive process. I sit down with our team, all our budget department managers, and we take a look at needs, who's coming on board. You know, so, of course, a big chunk of it has to do with staff and benefit costs. But we try and estimate when are they coming, who our needs are going to be, are we going to have any needs in IT? IT, you know, can come and go. We try and forecast as best we can, but Microsoft might have a reason to bump up a price, or, oh, you need a new update, and we need to worry about that. And I work very closely with Son and his team to figure out all our needs across the board. And also during the year, some things might change where we might have needs. And so we, you know, try and update as best we can. But we also take a look at other areas where if we don't need something, then we don't spend it. At least we try and forecast it. The idea being is that we want to place a budget in front of you that you're comfortable with, that's reasonable, okay? And if we get under that, that's great. You know, we just want to prevent any unforeseens.
Right, that was why I asked about the forecasting.
Absolutely.
All right. Any other questions? Jerry had a question.
Jerry. On page 4, just so I kind of get my arms around this, if you use round numbers, say $15 million for the project cost, and assuming, I guess, that we're probably going to start using that system late this calendar year or early next calendar year, then the depreciation starts at that time.
Correct.
Over 10 years. Is that incremental, or is it $1.5 million a year?
Yes.
Straight line?
Yes, straight
roughly.
Line.
So we can look forward to about a $1.5 million increase in the depreciation over 10 years?
Yearly.
Okay.
Yearly. And we'll prorate this year if we launch, say, for example, if we launch, you know, in the fourth quarter. So a quarter of it will land this year. The timing of it will be very interesting because right about the same time when we expect is when we're going to be preparing the budget for next year.
Right.
So that's another thing, too, is trying to anticipate. You prepare the budget in advance, how it's going to be next year, and so we, you know, drop numbers in.
Okay. I just couldn't recall whether or not it was straight line and just...
Yeah, if we had to worry about income taxes, which we don't, we could do accelerated depreciation and things of that nature, but we're not that fancy. You know, we're just straight line.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions of Henry? Samson.
Just looking at the office lease line item for both administrative and non-administrative, with the overage, what was the reasoning for that? It seems like leases are kind of the more predictable ones, unless your lease comes up for renegotiation.
It's a 10-year lease, okay. So from September 2019, but there is a line item where the leasehold company estimates for CAM charges, common area maintenance. As we look around, they do a good job of taking care of the place.
All right. You know,
parking, security, common areas, and there's also taxes and insurance. And so there's an allocation they do amongst the tenants and whoever's got leased up, and they do divvy it up. And so some of the costs were deferred. We didn't see them at the beginning. And about halfway through, we're starting to see them. And so we try and estimate and work with that office as best we can.
Okay.
But there were some little bit of ups there.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I've experienced the CAM charge surprise from commercial office leasing. It's you can't always predict it. Actually, you can't predict it. Yeah, it's not always. You just can't. So it's a bit of an unknown, right? I mean, that's something you can try to, you know, estimate, get, you know, guesstimate, stay close to the building folks to try to figure it out. But until it's done, it's not done. So,
and I'm certainly not complaining. It's great landscaping.
Yeah. No. What happens is, though, like if a building like this sold midterm in the lease, because this happened to me twice, the property tax juggernaut in the CAM charge is what you see in the next statement.
Gotcha.
So your taxes could literally double or certainly go up by 20 or 30%, and that'll be reflected. And you can't predict that because you're not connected to that sale at all.
Right. Right.
So it's challenging.
Well, the other thing that I've got, of course, is we got out of the old building and sold the old building at a very good time. have we done any analysis, just more out of curiosity of, you know, I'm curious what their occupancy rate is, you know, what the value of the building is now compared to what it was when we sold it and how we're doing. Yeah,
Willoway.
The former building?
Yeah,
yes.
Our old offices where, again, we had a lower lease rate, of course, because we were the landlords, but we sold it at a very opportune time.
Well, that, you know, that's a fascinating observation because, you know, when you drive by, it's gone through remodel like
right.
crazy, and it's, you know, very attractive. And we wonder, it's like, why didn't you do that when we were there, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, but so the mix of tenants there has also changed.
Yeah.
So it's almost like an apples and oranges,
okay.
you know, comparison. I think they're full, but I even stepped into the lobby and I remember where our boardroom used to be, and you know, they kind of divvied up the boardroom that some of the trustee remembers. Now that's very beautiful lights and everything like that, and so it's all carved out. I do know that they kind of parceled out into smaller chunks because they attract more revenue because it's
course.
In smaller pieces. So I'd like to say they're doing better, but they needed to invest in that building in order to get those revenues. And so it was just, you know, unfortunate. But I don't know. I like where we're at.
No, it's a great spot. Absolutely.
Right. I just think about, it's a good thing we didn't hold that asset past March of 2020.
Right.
Yeah. So it was really good timing, fortuitous timing, but good timing.
And I work closely, Sierra Pacific. You know, they're downstairs on the second floor, and I know their finance guy, and, you know, we sit down, show me those sheets. I need to, you know, estimate this a little better. And so they are as interested in not surprising us as well and trying to give us numbers as best we can. But it's a 10-year lease, and we're halfway through, and so soon enough we'll take a look. And
it's hard to believe we're halfway through.
Yeah, yeah, and for the first 5 years, we're getting a 2-month break, so we only pay for 10 months. We'll land it then. Yeah. So the timing was good, exiting the former and taking advantage at a good rate on this one.
There's some attractive rates in San Francisco right now. Just want to give you a little heads up on that.
We're not in the mood.
Yeah, that's right. I better get my BART pass ready.
All right.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
I have a couple.
Dennis.
Yeah, on page 4 on the assets and depreciation, the first column, original asset cost, that's the original, right? Do you have the remaining cost, or is it the remaining cost of the asset?
That's a good call. We'll put the remaining price. Some of these are going to go away because they're 5 years, and so they'll drop off. But that's a good call. That's not the remaining. That was the original price, and so okay. I guess
we... Yeah, that's what I thought, but it's interesting. It would be interesting to see how much assets actually remains. So,
correct.
Yeah. And also on the same page 4, but the top portion, for the pension system, does this include only Sagitek? Because I remember also have Seagull, right? And I think it's also capital spending.
Correct.
And internal labor that could be also capitalized or not. Usually, if it's in relation to the capital project, and even internal labor could be capitalized. At least that's how we.
You know, you could, Dennis. You know, but in consultations with Bron Armstrong, our auditors, that would border a little bit on being a little more aggressive. You know, on picking up internal labor, we'd have to measure and say, okay, how much of my time was devoted to this, how much time of, the retirement office. And that gets into some pesky calculations and timing and things like that. We could, but they're all cost. And then also you have to measure if you're testing, for example, the Siegel cost that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
That's program management. Under the accounting rules, that's not part of the asset cost. It's just an expense. That's part of your internal administrative cost. And in fact, that's why we had to get more of Siegel on their contract, because we were using Jesse and their team more. And that's one of the line items. Nobody brought it up, but over on page 1, our program, project consulting down at the bottom is shown an overage. In case if someone was curious, it's like, why is our project consulting up? It has to do with Siegel spending time on this budget.
Yeah. Okay. So this 12.6, it's just straight Sagitek, right?
Just Sagitek and some other programming supporting that. ICON.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is part of that.
So, yeah, ICON is a separate line item. So okay.
Correct. That's, correct. Then we call that all pension administrative costs. So anything in the design and the construction of it, the testing, the double checking, the troubleshooting, all of that, that's separate. Mm-hmm. That's just expense.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dennis. Any other questions for Henry? John.
Henry, on the percent remaining, I assume that's just a direct remaining the contract piece that hasn't yet been paid over the original contract.
Correct.
Do we have any measurement as to where we are as far as the actual work? One of the real issues on construction accounting is that you've got 5% of the contract left and 50% of the work.
Well, we do have a retention account installed on these. So we hold back approximately 12-13% of every payment, put it aside, call it for warranty. But it's not representative that this percent means that 66% of the work has been done. I'll leave that up for our next pension update, where people are closer to that. Jesse, some of the Sagitek personnel will be here, and they can reference. I would like to say that their work better be done more than what the money is. If they were here, I'd like to say they're 80% or 90% done.
Exactly.
Right? Or even better, if they came in here, well, we're done. Great. I want to be on that side of the fence.
Me too.
That's right. We can always cut you a check instantly, but getting the work done is really the story. So, no, it's not percent complete. It's just percent of the contract
And at this point, you don't have any overt concern that somehow we might not, there might be a big disparity between the percent left to pay and the percent of the work left to be done.
No, not at this point, because we have our retention account, so we're sitting in the warranty side now.
Good.
They're as interested to get the work done so they can get paid. So that's, and we're as interested in watching them do the work and signing off on the work so we could gladly pay them, but that's another piece. But from an accounting point of view, that's all I wanted to say. We're all committed to this project, but for financial statement reporting, this is where the asset resides right now. And you know, want to strike up the conversation that Jerry raised about the depreciation when it starts hitting.
Great.
All right. Thanks. Any other questions? Yes, Belinda.
So personnel services are the budget, and you mentioned it's due to some of the positions has not filled or filled later than expected. So what's the actual FTE and what's budgeted FTE? Do you know?
It's about 70 people is the budgeted, and right now we're trending maybe in 66, somewhere in that vicinity. There are some positions that we're closely looking to see. For example, I have an accounting position that I'm debating about when the timing is on that, because they're going to be supporting a lot of the effort of this new pension system. So as soon as we have a clear understanding where that is. But we place in the budget because it could be next week, well, we have needs now, or someone might depart. Just like we had a retirement services manager that left unforeseen, you know, we want to make sure. So it's always, you know, percentages coming and going. But the plan is every time we prepare a budget, this is our ideal plan of the number of people, what it takes to run the organization.
So they're very close currently. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We are, sure. Thank you, Glenda.
And you'll have a new deputy CEO in the quarter three. Am I right on that? Q3?
August 20th.
Yeah, August 20th. Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Yeah. Very good. Very
All right,
good.
Excellent. Anything well, else? Thank you, Henry, as
okay.
always.
Absolutely.
Very informative.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to item 8, which is to consider and take possible action to oppose Assembly Bill 2284, defining grade in Government Code Section 31461A. Karen, this is your item. The floor is yours.
Is my mic on? Yeah. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So this is a item that we're coming back to after the legislative update that we did back in June, focusing on one of the bills, which is AB 2284, and it has to do with defining the term grade in Government Code Section 31461A. That legal provision, statutory provision, is what defines compensation earnable for legacy members, meaning what compensation counts for retirement purposes. And so this bill would add a definition for the word grade in that statute to mean a number of employees considered together because they share similarities in job duties, schedules, unit recruitment requirements, work location, collective bargaining unit, or other logical work-related group or class as specified. And it would allow the retirement system to adopt that definition. And also recently, this bill was amended to require the County Board of Supervisors' adoption of that provision to be applicable in that county. What the bill does, according to the sponsors and according to the reading of that bill, is it would create a broader definition of what counts as compensation earnable by allowing basically subgroups within a group of employees that share the same job classification, allow them to be looked at as the group that if they earn a certain pay because of something that they all do, that pay would then be retirement compensable. So this bill has been studied by the 20 SACRS systems, by the Legislative Committee for SACRS, some retirement systems, and at least one county have already filed an opposition to this bill. So Los Angeles County, their SERL system, which is the biggest out of the 20 SERL systems, they are filing an opposition. Their board approved opposing this bill. The San Bernardino County retirement system has also opposed the bill. The Kern County retirement system filed an opposition, and also Kern County, so the county, the employer, the participating employer in Kern County, also filed an opposition. As you know, I sit on the SACRS Legislative Committee, and the committee studied the bill and voted to oppose it. And the committee is meeting with the SACRS board next week to discuss SACRS taking a position on the bill. So what we did internally at SACRS is I met with Christina, and thank you, Christina, for sharing all of your knowledge and expertise on this to kind of figure out, well, what does this mean for SACRS? Does SACRS have its own concerns with this bill that we should discuss with the board? The memorandum that you have in the packet outlines the list of concerns that SACRS has with this bill. Number one, the definition itself is inconsistent with current implementation. Currently, SACRS relies on the employer's classification of salary grades and position classifications. So the employer is the one that makes that determination and certifies that to SACRS. SACRS doesn't do its own independent decision analysis of what groups should be in what, you know, salary grades or classifications. Expanding the definition of compensation earnable by allowing the term grade to apply to these subgroups would be inconsistent with how SACRS currently handles this provision, and inconsistent with the employer's understanding. Number two, we have a concern that there would be an inconsistency among the SERL systems. So with this proposed change to the statute, as I said, counties can adopt it, and then SERL systems can then adopt this new definition. And then there would be an inconsistency, and that is important, especially when it comes to reciprocity, where members are working in two or more systems, and one of the system at some point will have to look to compensation that was earned in another system and whether that's pensionable. So you would have a situation where SACRS might have to make a determination on what happened over in another county, let's say San Diego County, how to define a subgroup within that. It's hard enough to do within our own county, but to have that analysis be done as to a member that worked at some point for another county would be very hard. There is law on that, the Stillman case on reciprocity, that held that the retirement system who's making the calculation on reciprocity has to apply its own rules to compensation coming from another county. So we would have to apply our own rule. There's another rule applied possibly in another county because of this statute. It creates inconsistency and probably somewhat of an almost impossible analysis to make. Number three, I mentioned it earlier, but it is legally the participating employers are the ones that set terms of employment compensation for their employees. So regardless of the definition itself, which is inconsistent with how we understand it, placing the role on the retirement system of making those determinations is incorrect. Number four, we do think that there's going to be a substantial administrative burden and likelihood of additional litigation on the definition of compensation earnable for CSERA. And lastly, it seems like the legislative change is unnecessary because there is always a possibility for the employer to classify a certain subgroup as their own class or their own salary grade, and that would potentially resolve this problem. So if you have a subgroup of folks doing working at a certain facility, getting a certain pay, potentially the employer could, define that group on their own. A little bit of background about this legislation is that it is the result of litigation that is currently pending in Orange County, where members sued the retirement system to have a certain pay included in their compensation earnable. Again, this only applies to legacy members, not PEPRA members. This has to do with the definition of compensation earnable for legacy members. So these legacy members over at Orange County would like to have a specific pay included that the retirement system declined to do. The case, prior to litigation, it went to an administrative law judge through an administrative hearing, and the recommendation from the administrative law judge was to find that that pay was compensable, that it did qualify as compensation earnable. However, then the system reviewed that recommendation and all the other evidence and determined that it is not pensionable. And then a lawsuit was filed. So the petitioners in that lawsuit are hoping that with this definition, if that's adopted in Orange County, it would allow them to have this pay included without the need to proceed in their litigation. My first reaction hearing this and reading the lawsuit in Orange County was that if they feel that they need a legislative fix, it should apply only to Orange County. But that's not how this this bill is written. It would be added to the 37 Act as a statute, a change to the definition that potentially would apply to all 20 systems if their counties adopt it. So our recommendation is for the CSERA board to oppose this bill and provide to the legislature this information about the concerns that we have with the bill.
All right. Thank you, Karen. I got a couple of lights on. I know, David, you had a comment. Jerry, I think you had your hand up. Do you want to speak now?
Yeah, I'd like to table the vote on this item until the SACRS Board of Directors has had the opportunity to hear from both sides regarding this issue that will happen on the 18th. So I'd like to table the vote until our next CSERA meeting.
So you would want to take it up on the 24th?
Correct.
Here, yeah. Right. And the Ledge Committee, the SACRS Legislative Committee has made a recommendation to the SACRS Board. Have I got that right?
They're going to have a discussion next week.
Okay. I didn't know if there was a written recommendation or this was done.
I haven't seen one.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, not as of yet. So I'd like to have the opportunity to have the Ledge Committee make their recommendation to the board in a formal manner. And then hear both sides.
And then you'd be able to bring back on the, well, I guess we'd know, but you would come back at least aware of what the discussion was at the SACRS board meeting. Is that the idea? And
yeah.
Bring the benefit of that back?
Right.
Okay. Jerry, did you have a comment or a question?
Two thoughts. One on yours, David. Is there something that prevents us from expressing our opinion at this point? Nothing that prevents us, but why would we want to necessarily forestall the opportunity to express our opposition to this and wait for SACRS to come up with a position?
Well, no. I mean, we could vote on it today as a board, but I would like to have the courtesy to hear all the arguments, pro and con, and hear from the legislative committee directly their reasonings. I mean, what Karen is saying is the analysis that you have done, right? That's not stating from the legislative committee what their arguments are. So I'd like to hear from the legislative committee what the recommendation is and why. And then I'd like to hear, we're also going to have some discussion from those who support the bill. And so I'd like to hear both sides of the story. So waiting for 2 weeks, I think gives Sarah time to be able to vote one way or the other before the legislature is back in session.
Yeah, you just made a good point that I don't know if it was covered earlier, but the legislature returns from its summer recess on August 5, is it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to take this up on the 24th, we would still have time to take an action and submit any action that we take to the, I don't know what the next committee to hear the bill is, but we would have the opportunity to do that. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The original comment I had is always this old adage about following the money. I'm a big believer in that. Who's carrying this bill and who's paying for it?
The sponsors are the peace officers and firefighters.
In Orange County?
I don't know who's paying for it, but they are listed when I looked at the legislative information that's published. The two organizations are listed as the...
It might be fair to conclude that they're paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And who's the sponsoring legislator? Whose bill is it?
Grayson.
Oh, Grayson. Yeah.
Assembly member Grayson.
He's becoming a rather reliable water carrier for certain groups. Okay, thank you.
Any other comments or questions? David, was that a motion? Is that a motion?
Yeah, I move to table this vote on this item until our next meeting on July 24th.
All right. Is there a second?
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second to continue the item for further consideration on July 24th. All right, any further discussion or questions on the motion? Hearing none. Let me get my chart back out here. All right, so on the motion to continue to the July 24 meeting, pending SACRS' Board of Directors' consideration of the item on July 18th, on the motion, Anderson.
Aye.
Jabotarev.
Aye.
Gordon. Aye. Holcomb.
No.
Kroll?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
Zhu?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
And Wong?
Aye.
All right, that motion carries 8-1. Sorry. Struggling with some basic math here. All right. Thank you, Karen. Very, very interesting discussion on that bill. Item 9. Consider and take possible action to amend the Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics. This is an action item. Christina or Karen? Who am I?
Karen.
Sorry.
Thank you again. this item is to have the board consider some amendments to the Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics. We haven't actually reviewed it for the purpose of making edits for a very long time. So some of the proposed edits are just simply updates to position names and that kind of thing. We did provide you with a red line copy of the code that reflects all of the suggested changes. The substantive ones, I summarized those for you in a memo. Basically, if you go to section 9, that is a substantive change there regarding communications between board members and service providers and other non-CICERA persons and entities. We're recommending updating those provisions to allow communications between the board's elected officers and non-CICERA persons in the ordinary course of conducting business, and to allow the CEO to either distribute written communications from board members to current service providers or post the written communications in the CICERA Dropbox file for review. So I think the purpose of that provision was to make sure that the full board, every trustee, is able to see these communications. So if one board member is having these communications, then the CEO provides a copy to all of the trustees, and this would add the ability to, instead of distributing the written communications, posting a copy of the communications on Dropbox so that the trustees can access it. We're suggesting creating an exemptions by which draft presentation materials received by the board's elected officers or board committee members in connection with reviewing proposed agenda item materials for presentation to the board would not need to be distributed by the CEO to all members of the board. This is just to streamline the process of if the board chair, for example, is receiving a draft presentation material for the purpose of the agenda, that doesn't need to be shared with the rest of the board. Of course, you can always request it if you wish. That's not an issue, but it would streamline the process to not have a requirement of distribution. Before I move on to the next item, are there any questions about this one, Section 9?
I don't have any questions about it, but I participated in the drafting of this just by way of full disclosure. This came up recently. It was actually, I think, the last board meeting where we had a significant presentation from Verus, and I had reviewed a very early rough draft of a Verus PowerPoint that Scott Whelan had provided me with the intention to get some input from me as board chair about, size, content, how big, how long, all that kind of stuff. And so Scott, Tim Price, and myself had it was about a half-hour Teams call to look at this material, which I got the morning of just before the call. I took a look at it, gave a lot of, real-time feedback and input to Scott and Tim, and suggested that maybe they reorient the PowerPoint slides in a different way in terms of presentation. I think ultimately that resulted in moving a number of the PowerPoint slides from the presentation mainstream to the appendix for further review if people wanted to. Anyway, that whole interaction gave rise to the fact that it was a large amount of material, as you know, on the asset liability study that came before us anyway. And so the idea was if we were then going to have board members read all of that material and then get sent a completely different file of a lot of the same, actually all the same material, it was a lot of material. And so my reaction, and I discussed it with our CEO, was that's a lot to ask of people shortly before a meeting. So we opted, and I think it was the right call, to put it in Dropbox to let everybody know. I made that announcement at the board meeting. If you really want to dive in and look at what the raw PowerPoint looks like, have at it, right? So anyway, the genesis of this is that circumstance where if we're trying to manage board business, we might have some direct interaction with a consultant. In this case, it was Verus. And so those are drafts, and you know we'll have them available in Dropbox. But it's at least under this change, they wouldn't be required to be sent out to everybody. So anyway, that's the purpose of the change. I just wanted to be very open about that. So anyway, I interrupted your flow, so go ahead.
No, thank you very much. Thanks for elaborating on this and proposing the language. I think it's a very good way to streamline the process. So moving on to Section 11 regarding non-compliance sanctions. So this is an interesting one. It basically tells us, well, what's going to happen if a board member violates the code? And I had discussions about this with the board's fiduciary counsel, Ashley Dunning. Luckily, at Cicera, we haven't had this come up, which is great. But she, in her role advising other boards, had some edits that she suggested that the board can discuss and consider whether you're interested in making. Basically, the censorship, currently the provision says that if there's a violation, the board chair and the board as a whole would take action to censor the board member, right, for their violation. So Ms. Dunning proposed also adding a private censorship, which is where the board chair would privately censor the board member, so that does not require board action. And also, in the event it's the board chair who is the violator, the next board officer in line would have that authority. And of course, we have a note in the code, and I just want to remind you that in addition to censure, the board also has the ability to pursue all of its legal remedies against any board members who violates the provision of the code, in addition to the censorship.
This is always the happy part of the discussion right here.
Could you stay after class?
Yeah, we have a little something we need to go over.
I actually have a question. Who decides if statute was violated, like for private, I guess, censors? Like, does just Scott decides, okay, Dennis violated something and talks to me, or is it still board and then decides it, and then Scott is in power to censor?
So that's a good question. So the way it's written now, it would be the board who makes that decision, but this proposes a private censorship by the chairperson. I would think that we would have a fiduciary counsel involved in the analysis of the situation and whether the violation occurred.
So based on that, I hadn't really thought about this a lot. Wishful thinking. I'm hoping this one doesn't come to pass. But if you had a situation where a board was making a determination, would that be a closed session discussion under one or more personnel exceptions under the Brown Act? So in other words, if the board were going to take that action, kind of defeats the purpose of a private approval if you're having a very public discussion about a matter.
It would most likely be a public discussion unless it fits within an exception in the Brown Act, such as potential litigation, or it's not, so board members are not employees, so it wouldn't come under that exception.
Well, I mean, I like the approach that has been fashioned here. Yeah, I don't have any problem with that, but it might be something that I would suggest maybe talking to Ashley about, as to whether there's a means to address that. The good news is, to my knowledge, this hasn't come up in the whole time I've been around, 10 years or so. And I'm hoping this is an outlier, very, very, you know, rare occasion. But in the event it did, there's sort of an inconsistency to me to have a private approval, but a whole public discussion leading up to a determination, because that strikes me as sort of contradictory.
I don't think you would have a public discussion in the private censorship. What we are proposing here would be a private censure authority for the board chair, so there wouldn't be a public discussion.
So in that, so I guess that's where I was a little unclear based on the prior discussion. So in that scenario, there isn't a board determination that precedes the chair's ability to make that call on a case-by-case basis.
Correct.
I may have misunderstood that. All right.
And again, this is a proposal for the board's consideration. If you have questions or you're uneasy with making a change, any changes to Section 11, that's fine as well. It's really just the first time for us, for the board, to kind of think about these things. And again, it hasn't come up at all for many years, to my knowledge. So it's not anything urgent, but it's something to think about.
Well, based on that clarification, I mean, it makes sense to me. And as I say, it hasn't happened in the time I've been around. So I think it would be a rarity in any event. But I think the process that's described here is a good one.
Okay.
Any other thoughts or comments from board members on this?
Just to, not to nitpick this thing, but I found on page 5...
on the red line,
you look at either one because it carries forward to the finished version. Item 9 shall be. There's a subject verb disagreement here. So communications, even if they disagrees, there shouldn't be with an S there.
Yes, thank you.
So I don't know if there's other instances in which that change appears, but we might want to do a little search and destroy.
Yes,
we'll
thank
look
you.
At that. And I had a question, if I could, but maybe I should wait until the end of the conversation, but whether or not there's a style guide of sorts that has been set up. As we go through these organizations and we get the language all nicely woked up, do we have a method by which each time we review one of these, make sure that the same items are carried through in those documents too? The checklist to make sure that if we're concerned about he, she, that it becomes they in every document. So is there a process to make sure that there is a checklist of items to make sure that these things are carried through? I prefer to see some consistency from document to document.
Yes.
So the chair is not used here and chairperson is used there.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do, and we like consistency as well. So we match this up. Some of the changes here to, you know, from chair to chairperson, that mirrors the regulations.
Yeah.
So we want consistency.
Because we got a ton of documents out there.
Correct. Yeah.
The binder, as I recall, is about yay thick. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm sorry. That one just jumped out at me. There may be some other typos, but I probably not. But I just saw that one.
Thank you.
Okay. No, it's a good question because I think what's probably going to come down the road, not too much further down the road, is probably an update or a refresh to the board regulations. I know that Christina and I have had that discussion on some of the matters that pertain to administration of meetings, and there's probably myriad things in the regulations that need to be updated, both for terminology and just things that are no longer relevant or need to be updated. So I think
some
it's timely.
Some are probably as a result of codes, but some are internal consistencies I'm sure we'd like to have. Thanks.
All right. Any other comments or questions on the proposed changes to the Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics? None? Seeing none? Is there a motion on this item?
Motion to accept the changes, proposed changes. Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded to accept the proposed changes to amend the Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics. Any further questions or discussion on the item? Hearing none, let's vote on the motion. Anderson?
Aye.
Chabotarev?
Aye.
Gordon? Aye. Holcomb?
Aye.
Kroll?
Aye.
MacDonald?
Aye.
Zhu?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
And Wong?
Aye.
All right, that motion carries 9-0. Thank you, and thanks for all the effort on that, Karen and Christine. I think that is a good step forward. All right, item 10, consider authorizing the attendance of the board under item A to the CalPERS Trustees Roundtable, October 11 in San Jose. So this is a close to the public item, so max 4, I believe, is the rule.
I'll be interested in, but I'd like to wait on the agenda to see what it's about.
All right. So because the agenda hasn't been sent out, proposed yet, is it, I guess we can move up to 4 and then decide who goes when people can zero in on it and take a closer look at it. Is that fair? All right. Does somebody want to make that motion to approve four?
So moved.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded to approve four to attend the CalPERS Trustee Roundtable October 11, 2024 in San Jose. Seeing no other questions or comments on the motion, let's call the roll. Anderson.
Aye.
Chubadarev.
Aye.
Gordon. Aye. Holcomb.
Aye.
Kroll.
Aye.
McDonald.
Aye.
Zhu.
Aye.
Phillips.
Aye.
And Wong.
Aye.
All right. That motion carries 9-0. Thank you. The next item is the CRCEA Annual Fall Conference, November 3 to 6, in beautiful downtown Walnut Creek, hosting here locally. This is open to the public, so there's no limitation on the number of members that can attend. Well, Mike?
One thing, too, that, you know, I have to apologize. Somehow this got out a couple weeks ahead. We planned to put it out with the agenda.
Unfortunately, it has not gotten out. The only thing I can do for you at this time is kind of give you an overview of the plan that we have. Candace has agreed to represent the Board of Supervisors and welcome the conference. Hank Kim from NCPRS will be our keynote speaker. We will be having the FBI agent Jimmy Hassani, who spoke at the Sackers Indian Wells a year ago, will be also there to talk, give us a little bit more input about recent computer scam updates and safety. We'll have a CHP will be there on a two-hour presentation, be Tuesday just before lunch, and then another hour after lunch. They have to do a two-hour presentation, but it's a program they call Age Well, Drive Smart, but it's similar to AARP's program for mature drivers, and those that sit through the two-hour conference will get a certificate, which is good for a discount on your auto insurance. So I think that's going to be of some value. We'll also have a speaker talk about reverse mortgages for, you know, those who have issues with financing their homes. Amy Brown, which is a CRCEA lobbyist, will be there to discuss the new issues. So maybe she won't be there because this is Tuesday, which is election day, but one of her staff will be there. So one way or the other, we'll have somebody from her office. And then we'll have another one, investing after retirement. And what the heck do you do with your RMD whenever it hits instead of just putting it in your savings account? Again, like I said, it's going to be at the Walnut Creek Embassy Suites Hotel. We were able to get $169 a night fee, which I thought was fantastic. That includes breakfast and a nightly hospitality. We will be actually setting aside, we've had their hospitality before, and for free you can't bitch, but you get popcorn and crackers and, you know, a drink, but we're going to expand it, and we'll have an area set aside that'll be an expanded hospitality as opposed to what they offer.
So you have some cookies, cookies on the side and that sort of thing? Nice. Nice, very nice.
So anyway, we one reason why we decided on that is because people are coming from Southern California, and it's right next to the BART track, so it's convenient for them to get on a plane, get on the BART, and actually just step right off the BART. So you know, we're hoping for that's going to be convenient. I'm sorry?
Have you heard about BART or sending them the, well, see, no, send them the app to report something if you're not comfortable. I'm sorry. And again, I just...
I'm trying not to get into the weeds here.
Okay, no. Yeah. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah. It sounds like most of the guests will be armed.
Well,
hopefully it'll be, you know, they'll get there earlier in the morning and all the criminals will be sleeping. I don't know. But anyway, you're all welcome. We encourage you to attend, even if you want to come for just a part of the day. Or I will get, I'll get with Christina. I'm not sure how you want to distribute that out or wait till the next meeting on 24th to have the agenda.
I can email it out.
Okay, so I'll get that to you ASAP, and then everybody can make up their mind which ones or any of them that they would like to attend.
All right. Thank you, Mike. So this item is open to the public, and I guess unless Luz is going to look at me and tell me it creates an administrative nightmare, we could approve all board members attending and then let it sort out as to whether that'll work out. Is that something we can do? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm getting nods. Didn't get anything thrown at me. All right. Does somebody want to authorize all board members to attend?
So moved.
Moved, seconded. Any further discussion? Any final pitch, Mike?
Come on.
All right. Let's vote on the motion. Anderson?
Aye.
Chabadara?
Aye.
Gordon? Aye. Holcomb?
Aye.
Kroll?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
Zhu?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
And Wong?
Aye.
All right. That motion carries 9-0. Thank you. And the next item is item C, which is the IFEBP 70th Annual Employee Benefits Conference, November 10 to 13 in San Diego. Of course, that's during SACRS, I think. This is closed to the public, so this would be up to four members. Are there any board members interested in the IFEBP 70th Annual Employee Benefits Conference? I know David's not going to be one of them. I'm not seeing anybody, so we'll pass on that item. If somebody thinks about it, remind me before we finish, and we can go revisit that. Item D, the 2024 Invesco Real Estate Global Conference, November 12 to 14, 2024, in San Diego, likewise closed to the public, also same week as SACRS.
I went to that last year. It's fantastic. It's an outstanding.
It's a very good conference.
November is killing me. I've got the CRCA and I've got the SACRS and I can't put that on top of that, so I would end up 3 weeks away from home.
All right. I've got a.
I'm sorry.
She thinks that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2 weeks is good. Then somebody's got to take the trash out.
Yeah, I've got a trial scheduled to start on November 12th, so I'm not going to be available to go anywhere that week, at least not currently. I don't see anybody with their hands up on this one, so we'll pass. Interesting that this might be a first that no one would attend the Invesco conference, but that could be. If that changes, we can always bring it back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's leave it at that. We'll pass it for now. And item E is a due diligence meeting visit. It's a quick turn. It's next week on the 17th. I think both David and I initially expressed an interest in this. I know, David, you've got a conflict. I think you indicated. And I'm not going to be able to make that. So I don't know if any other board member, though, is available and could make that meeting. It is in New York, July 17th. It's next Wednesday. I assume Tuesday would be your travel day, if I got it right. Any board member interested in attending the due diligence visit? Nope, not seeing anybody. So we'll pass on that. I think that takes us out of item 10, brings us to item 11 on the agenda. Miscellaneous. Christina, staff report.
I don't have any, but Karen does.
All right.
I do. Just a couple of things. An update on the case happening in Los Angeles County. In that county, the Los Angeles Retirement System sued Los Angeles County over the responsibility, authority to appoint personnel to the retirement system and set their compensation. That case went up on appeal. The appellate court issued its decision, siding with the LACERA board, the retirement board, and finding that the retirement board has the authority under the Constitution to administer the fund, which includes appointing employees that work at the retirement office and setting compensation. This is really big news in the SERL system world because many of the other systems are having issues dealing with their county on the retirement system being able to appoint employees and set compensation. I do think that it'll be taken up for review by the Supreme Court because this decision is in conflict with another Court of Appeals decision that came down a while ago in the context of CalPERS. So it wasn't a Searle system issue, but it was CalPERS. And so I think we'll hear more from the Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, on this case. But for now, Lacerra should be congratulated for getting a good decision in its favor. And my second update is that we have arranged with the board's fiduciary counsel to provide to the board the required ethics training next year. It'll be in January. So Ashley Dunning will provide that mandatory ethics training for you at a board meeting in January. We'll then alternate between that and doing the fiduciary education each year. So next year in January, you'll get the ethics training, and the following year in 2026, you'll receive the fiduciary training.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Question? Okay. So Lacerra is suing to be more autonomous.
Correct.
Like Cicera.
Years ago.
Like Cicera set the precedent, right? So they prevailed, and L.A. County's not happy with that, so they're
Correct.
Going to appeal. Okay. So is there any potential impact on Cicera's status as an autonomous? And to
no.
me, I mean, if L.A. County prevails, I mean, it's not like Contra Costa County is, I think they're happy with the arrangement we have now, but I mean, that's not going to reverse our own history, right?
It's a really, really good point that you made, David. No, I don't think it would have any impact on Cicera. In Contra Costa County, there is a statute that was adopted to allow, require basically in the Cicera situation for the Board of Retirement to be the appointing authority for personnel and for setting salaries. So that legislation created a statutory district status for Cicera. So the Lacerra decision wouldn't impact Cicera in any way.
I don't see my board wanting to pull back that power. Somehow, I think they're very happy with the way things are going.
Yeah. And there was, my recollection is the statutory change devolved from a settlement agreement, right? Was there a written settlement agreement? So in order to unwind
It would
that,
be much more complex.
Yeah.
No, there's never, it's never come up.
All right. Any other questions for Karen? Seeing none. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Very interesting. And finally, trustee comments. Any trustee comments?
I have kind of comment and question. In light of what happened to Patelka, right? I mean, probably most people know. Do we have like a contingency plan? How are we going to pay retirees? If something similar happens, I mean, nobody wants it to happen, but I had Patelka for forever, and then I couldn't get any money from it. So just and with a new system coming up, right? So do we have something in a contract with them? So how, because yeah, if just basically want to continue paying people if something like that happens.
Maybe we could have a closed session to talk about our cybersecurity protections that we do have in place. I'm actually doing this on the Board of Supervisors and another committee I serve on it's actually the full board, just because we have continued to implement in Contra Costa County some significant changes to protect us from cyber attacks, mm-hmm. from ransomware attacks, and I think it would be helpful to bring that to us. I serve on another agency where we just went through a very significant ransomware attack. But because we had insurance and because we were storing our data in the cloud as opposed to on a server that they got into, we had almost no disruption whatsoever. And so I think it would be helpful if we could
be brought up to speed on what we're doing, but I wouldn't do it in an open session because it's right. confidential information that shouldn't be made privy to those who we don't want having it.
Right. So we actually have periodically scheduled closed session updates for our board, and we've done it previously under the personnel matter because it's an ongoing job responsibility and duty of the CEO. So it's a periodic report that we get. We haven't done one for several months. But what I can't remember is in the interim, and I should know the answer to this, what was the Brown Act amended finally to
it,
there's a bill pending. Right. So I think at the next available opportunity, and that may not be on the 24th, but on maybe the first meeting in August, we can agenda that, take it up in closed session. I think that's appropriate. Yeah. Excellent. And we can hope that the bill passed so that the Brown Act makes clear that boards can meet in closed session to discuss cybersecurity. It's really, there's disparate practice all over the state on that item.
And just as a quick comment, since it'll be a while before we have that, we do have a business continuity plan in place, and we do have cybersecurity in place that are constantly being tested. So just as an overall very high level, we do have things. And if you want to talk with me individually, I can talk more about that. We hire a company to come in, and we rotate companies.
Not that there's been attempts to test our firewalls and all that.
Well, that's probably what we can't really be talking about.
Yes, yes.
Fair enough.
But
and I don't want to say I got a funny phishing attempt 2 weeks ago that involved two members on this board asking them to. Scott allegedly was asking me to make a payment because Scott was not available. The other Scott was not available. And did you get the same?
John got one.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Can you please, you know, pay this money? I'll make sure we make you whole at the end. I mean, it was such a blatant phishing. So there's the more subtle things, but then there's also.
Oh, no. Yeah, we were on a patient call yesterday, and while we were there, someone from the policeman's ball called for seeking a donation.
Oh yeah, no, I get that all the time. That's just.
I think if Dennis was asking, we know why.
Yeah. Yeah. Gift cards.
Yes.
Yeah, gift cards.
I love it.
Crypto.
Yeah, we followed up on that other item, and we're continuing to follow up on it. It's unclear to me if it's actually related to Cicera or whether that was a...
Well, it's probably someone who saw at least board. I mean, they knew we were all interconnected. And, John, if you were also targeted, they got our email addresses from online somehow.
Yes.
Noting that we were...
Yeah, it was an interesting assemblage of publicly available information and some basic AI recognition of relationships between people. But I don't think we actually know the genesis of that. In fact, I'm pretty confident we don't at this point.
Well, and the other thing, since we're discussing it, although it's not on the agenda, the county is also taking very serious steps as to the use of AI by county employees. Because a lot of the AI that you subscribe to, you check a box that says they can use whatever information you generate, create for their own purposes to further train their AI bot. But the reality is if you're using AI and creating confidential information, then that's being put out there, which someone else may potentially be able to utilize. And so I don't know if that's a guideline that we're going to be working on to really ensure that within our Cicera structure, we really have very extreme restrictions. I understand Microsoft has a product that you can use that has some security functions that will allow you to utilize some AI, but not have this potential for it being sold on the dark web someday.
I think, it's an excellent point, and I would just say without being too granular here that maybe that's something we can add to the discussion point on our cybersecurity discussion when we have it, because I think it's becoming a serious issue. I know that some of my private clients have taken fairly dramatic steps with their IT side to foreclose the use of company devices to access ChatGPT and other AI sources. Yeah.
nationwide pension attorneys forum that we hold twice a year, and policies regarding AI usage was one of the topics.
Oh,
it's something that Christina and I have talked about as well. Systems are taking various approaches from limiting it. Some are actually very liberal with it and would like it to be used, but placing some restrictions on what type of information you can put out there, because it does then become part of the public domain, so we can't really put any confidential information on any of the AI vendors. So, yeah, it is something that's being discussed up and down the state.
Excellent point.
And just to add to that, I also had a meeting with Siegel Consulting because it seems like they do everything, but they also write AI policies. And so I've been talking to them about what that would look like, as well as with SON from an IT standpoint of what we can restrict access to.
Excellent. Any other trustee comments? Everybody talked out? All right. Well, thank you all. We stand adjourned, and we'll see you on the 24th.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hadn't...